The next paper is entitled Science in Default, 22 Years of Inadequate UFO Investigations by Dr. James E. McDonald, Senior Physicist, Institute for Atmospheric Physics, and Professor of Meteorology, University of Arizona.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The AAAS, I think, is to be congratulated for organizing and holding this symposium. I fully agree with the remarks that Dr. Sagan made, that there is a scientific obligation to examine questions such as that of the unidentified flying objects, an obligation of the public to science itself. And as the title of my remarks indicates, my study of the problem leads me to take the position that we in science are in default, have been in default for two decades, for failing to close with a problem that created such widespread concern, both here and abroad, failing to close with it long ago. I want to get across to you the viewpoint that, again, based on my examination problem, that it is primarily the failure of scientists to look at this problem closely, and not primarily the Air Force mishandling the problem that has left it in a limbo that it still lies in 1969. When I suggest that I regard all 22 years as adding up to inadequate UFO investigations, I'm including, quite intentionally, essentially all that has transpired, including the most recently conducted Condon Report. If you go back, as I have done in the last 3 years of checking the problem, and look carefully at Project Sign and its contents and conclusions, if you look carefully at what you can get a hold of in Project Grudge and its conclusions, if you look, as I have, at Wright-Patterson files, and then go over very carefully the original monthly Project Blue Book reports, and then Project Blue Book Report 14, and examine the record as the years have gone by, look at it in terms of just ordinary, run-of-the-mill scientific standards of investigation, look at it carefully, I think you would have to agree that it is inadequate and it has been very superficial. Suggestions that the Air Force has put any appreciable talent onto the Air Force problem over the years does not match at all what one finds at Blue Book. There has not been application of the best scientific facilities available to the United States Air Force, as press releases have over and over again suggested. That is not the case. Even as obvious an organization as Air Force Cambridge Research Labs, with its substantial talent, only in one very brief period in 1952 were brought into the picture, and again, Air Force radar cases have failed to be put before the kind of people in Air Force organizations that really have the expertise to look at them. So contrary to what we in the scientific community were told as the years went by, when you look at the nature of the investigations in individual reports, you are quite surprised. And my position there is quite clear. It is superficial and it is not competent investigation that has gone into Project Blue Book. If a lot of time permitted, I would discuss a lot of particular illustrations of that point. Time doesn't permit it. I simply put myself clearly on record as describing the problem in those terms. A fairly large share of Air Force explanations have pretty much fallen in my area of interest, atmospheric physics. Another broad cut of them goes into astronomy in a fairly elementary way. And it was the atmospheric physics problem that got me interested in the UFO problem some time ago, and particularly in 1966. I took upon myself to get up to Wright-Patterson, and my interest in the UFO problem went through a step function change after 3 days of poring over the Wright-Patterson files. They are astonishing, in my opinion. Cases that I had never believed that I had heard about are really there. And cases, the documents of which are frequently quite extensive, and I want to turn to some of them fairly shortly. My encounter with the Wright-Patterson files was one of extremely great surprise that so much evidence could be just shoved in the rug for so many years and not be put under real light of scientific scrutiny. While the years have gone by, the reports have continued to come in, the public has continued to be puzzled, and due to a sequence of events that occurred in 65 and 66, a new look was finally suggested, primarily by the O'Brien Committee, and this eventuated as the Condon Report, and that is the last and undoubtedly the most presently relevant part of the 22 years of investigation. And to say that again, my study of the Condon Report, and I've been putting a great deal of my time on it for the past 9 months, checking many cases that weren't previously familiar to me and going over the content evaluations of those already familiar to me. I would have to say there that, once again, it is not a thoroughgoing and adequate investigation of the UFO problem. The conclusions that Dr. Condon reached in his summary analysis that the problem doesn't merit further scientific study, I think is not at all supported by the contents of the report, as the previous speaker, I believe, also suggested. As a matter of fact, of the sample of cases, and I now want to talk about the Condon report briefly, of the roughly 90 cases that are looked at, approximately a third, it's a little difficult to decide in many instances what the final conclusion is in specific cases. My tally is that about 32 out of the 89 or 90 cases are in the unexplained category. And I think that point has to be stressed very emphatically, and I think it's very significant that a major effort mounted by the Air Force and funded with substantial amount of money ended up with approximately a third of all the cases that it considered not explained in any satisfactory degree. Furthermore, a substantial number of the 90 cases are just not interesting cases. Cases that I think experienced investigators would have looked at twice are given fairly large amounts of attention, quite a few crackpot cases. If there's anything that can be separated out easily in the UFO problem, it's the crackpot cases, yet some of them even made their way into the final report. Another major objection that I would cite to the Condon report is that, in contrast to what I think many of us expected, a careful confrontation with some of the most puzzling historic cases that date back to 47, 48, 49, for example, the Condon report has very few of the historically most puzzling cases, and some of these are left unexplained. Some of the small number of those that do appear in the sample are left unexplained. Others are, quote, explained away with scientific argumentation that I take the strongest issue with, and again, I will cite some examples. There are cases that were investigated that don't appear at all in the report. Levelin, Texas is an example, one that I think a number of us here are familiar with, that was investigated, that doesn't appear at all, occurred at Redlands, California in early 1968, in February 4th. I interviewed about eight witnesses. Professors at the University of Redlands interviewed about 25. This was a case of a large number of people hearing unusual sounds, getting out in the street, looking up, and from a variety of directions that, crudely speaking, triangulated moderately well, indicated an object at about 1,000 feet elevation ultimately. Early it was about 300 feet, estimated to be about 50 or 60 feet in diameter when most of the people were out looking at it, and all that I interviewed were watching it. It was making no sound, hovering motionless. Was a disc-shaped object with a luminous surface around the side of it. It suddenly shot up two or three times its original height, estimated 300 up to about 1,000, moved off a distance of several blocks, seen by still other people. This case, and finally moved off, this case was explained to the Air Force as a small aircraft. There were no aircraft in the area at the time, as the University of Redlands people ascertained. I cite this as an example. Of a case investigated by the Condon report, which didn't even get into the report at all. But the primary objection that I would make to the Condon evaluations are scientific. The scientific argumentation involved, I think, it leaves a very great deal to be desired in terms of discussion of radar cases, meteorological optical phenomena, aeronautical effects, and so on. But let me turn next to some specific examples of cases in the Condon report that come from Air Force files. I'm trying to kill a number of birds, or at least throw stones at a number of birds here, with a minimum number of stones and maximum birds. So I'm going to now discuss four specific cases that, to me, illustrate reasons why one must scientifically say there exists a problem here, that there are unexplained phenomena of serious scientific interest, that illustrate shortcomings of the past level of Air Force investigations of the problem, that illustrate shortcomings of the Condon project investigation or of the final conclusions, and that finally are just plain crying for scientific attention. The first case that I want to talk about occurred in 1957, September 19th and 20th of 1957, involves an Air Force RB-47. This is all four of these cases I'm talking about are Condon report cases. All four are Air Force related. This case was reported rather casually to the staff of the Condon project when a group of Air Force UFO officers were called in for a briefing session. One of them, a then major, now colonel, Chase, from then Malmstrom, but now retired, mentioned briefly the incident. They got tape recordings from him. These were discussed within the project, and the case was particularly discussed for Dr. Cummins' benefit. But in the Cummins report, this very intriguing case is rather briefly and very incompletely passed off, and Dr. Cunningham himself, in his discussion, does not even mention this particular RB-47 case. The RB-47 was coming out of Forbes Air Force Base, a night exercise down over the Gulf, gunnery and navigation exercises, and then coming in north for ECM exercises against ground radar, simulating enemy penetrations, and using ECM gear aboard this RB-47, because it was an ECM-equipped plane. It didn't have three, but rather six Air Force officers. The Condon investigators stopped when they had contacted three. I eventually located all six, and it was well worth the search to get further information on this case. They were flying a little after midnight, early morning hours, at around 35,000 feet, at cruising speed of the order of 500 knots. And the incident begins, and you have no information about this in the Condon report. The incident begins over Gulfport, Mississippi, when Major McClure, on the number 2 ECM radar monitor, received a signal from a peculiar location. It was coming in from an apparent position out over the Gulf, as they were northbound over Gulfport, Mississippi, and a blip on his display scope for the ECM monitor indicated some kind of a radar signal coming in from out on the Gulf. That could have been a ship of some kind, but as McClure watched, the blip on the scope moved up scope, indicating that it couldn't be out as a stationary object out in the Gulf. He thought for a first hypothesis that this was a ground-based radar, perhaps somewhere up in Louisiana or Arkansas, and that it was displaying with 180-degree ambiguity on his ALA-6 display scope, and that whereas it seemed to be going up this way, it was really out there, and their motion was making it move down scope, and 180-degree ambiguity was reversing the signal. He didn't say anything about this to the other man, and didn't even say anything about the signal when a still more startling feature occurred. When it got up to the 12 o'clock position dead ahead, instead of stopping, it went down the other side. And that took out of consideration the possibility that this was any stationary ground signal from a CPS 6B or something like that out in the area ahead, because it had now essentially orbited the B-36. I asked McClure very carefully, and apparently the Condon investigators did not, what were the detailed characteristics of this signal. And he's now stationed off at Air Force Base where I located him. He was quite emphatic in saying this, in all respects, had pulse characteristics, signal characteristics of a fairly standard type of a typical ground surveillance radar. It was at 2,800 megacycles. That's why he got it on his monitor. It was a pulsed signal. The pulse characteristics, repetition frequency, and so on were entirely similar to ground radar. And he said the strangest thing of all was that it even simulated a scan rate. So a little surprised that when he first found it, he thought it must be a ground radar. I want to emphasize that I'm not talking here about somebody in an airplane looking at something with radar. It needs to be emphasized that we're talking here about a passive direction-finding radar monitor that does no more than receive the signal from an enemy radar, get its pulse characteristics through a pulse analyzer, and above all get its directions, get directional bearings on it. And that's the type of device I'm talking about here. Well, he still said nothing to the crew about this until the next incident occurred, and this is mentioned in the Condon report, though you have no notion. Again, I'm getting across to you the point that when you read the Condon report, you very frequently, can cite many examples, very frequently are getting a most truncated account of the report. You have the impression in reading this account that it all occurred in the general vicinity of Fort Worth and a little bit over in Louisiana. But these events that I've just cited began in Gulfport, Mississippi, and this unidentified phenomenon was with them for 600 miles and 1 hour instead of being a very localized and brief encounter such as one I think would read from the Condon report. They turned westbound over Jackson, Mississippi, and the pilot, Colonel Chase, suddenly got on the intercom announcing to the crew they should be prepared for a sudden evasive maneuver because he thought a jet was closing fast, landing lights on, a bright light coming in a little bit above their level. And just before he could put his craft into an evasive turn, the object very suddenly, and Chase's description was a little saltier than that, but briefly it came to the conclusion that in his 20 years of flying with the Air Force, he had never seen anything move as rapidly as this bright, luminous source shifted from his 11 o'clock position almost instantaneously, as you could see it move across, but shifted to their 2 o'clock position and blinked out. So here was a light that came in a little above 35,000 foot B-47 altitude, intensely bright, was taken to be jet landing lights, but suddenly moved through about 45 or 60 degrees of arc and then blinked out. They got on the, Chase was on the intercom and said something about this light and made some brief comment about maybe it was a flying saucer. And that, for the first time, led McClure to wonder about whether the incident that I just mentioned a moment ago back over Gulfport might be something a little out of the ordinary, beyond the electronic range. And so McClure turned, retuned his ECM monitor to the same frequency on which he had been receiving these radar-like signals from the peculiar orbiting, seemingly orbiting source, and found again that he was getting the signal at this position where it had blinked out. It was no longer a luminous source at that position. The ECM monitor, however, did get a strong signal, the same characteristics, 2800 megacycles, from that position, and he then reported this to the cockpit crew and pointed out what had happened back over Gulfport. They proceeded to try to all the usual maneuvers to change speed and so on, but they couldn't shake the source that stayed with them now at the same 2 o'clock position, there again indicating it was not any ground-based device, because they're moving ahead at 500 knots. Had it been a new, and could have been another radar source in the ground, it would have again moved down scope as their as they advanced forward. It stayed with them. So Colonel Chase contacted Carswell GCI and asked if there was any traffic there. GCI immediately announced, yes, there's an aircraft 10 miles from you at your 2 o'clock position. So at this point, the source was non-luminous, was emitting radar-like signals, was getting skin paint return from a radar on the ground, and from this time to the end of the object was being tracked by ground radar radars out of GCI Carswell Air Force Base. Shortly after they first got word that it was being tracked on radar from GCI, passive monitor and GCI simultaneously reported to the cockpit crew, the ground radar by radio, and McClure by intercom, that the signal was moving forward. Compatible behavior moving forward relative to the B-47, until it got dead ahead at the 12 o'clock position, and then suddenly blinked back on with a bright, luminous, red light this time. And Chase's description was big as a house. It had been white before, was now red, dead ahead. So at this juncture in this incident, there are three different physical channels of information coming in. Radar, skin paint from the ground, ECM monitor receiving electromagnetic radiation in the radar and the radar frequencies from the source dead ahead, and visual optical frequencies, pilot and co-pilot. I've talked, as I say, to the co-pilot as well as the pilot and all four of the other men. They attempted to close, went to full power, couldn't close on it, stayed ahead of them. They were by this time moving across eastern Texas and to Fort Worth. It veered northwestward over Fort Worth. They got clearance to depart from the original flight path, got all of the jet aircraft out of the area, and went to maximum power, attempting to close on it, when suddenly it stopped on the GCI radar. The GCI announced it was not moving any longer. Colonel Chase described it as becoming quite obvious that he was closing rapidly on it, still emitting 2800 megacycle signal, until he nearly got over it, and by that time he veered a little, but it was below his altitude, he stressed, so he's looking at it down at depression angle, which he put it more than 45 degrees, and suddenly three things happened simultaneously. It blinked out. It disappeared from the ECM monitor. It disappeared from Carswell GCI. These are puzzling phenomena. He put the 47 into a strong turn, got it by about Mineral Wells, Texas, half around, and he and McCoy, looking back over the shoulder out of the booster of the 47, suddenly saw the intensely red light come on, now much below their flight altitude. Simultaneously, GCI said it's back on the scope, and McClure in the back end and Provenzano on another monitor announced it was back on the two monitors. I should interject the comment that after McClure announced his earlier sighting, they found it on one of the other three ECM monitors. So they were tracking it on two ECM monitors, and it came back on at the same time that it came back visually and came back on GCI. Chase got permission to dive on it in the B-47. And shortly before he got to somewhere near its altitude, specifically when he got to 20,000 feet in his account, he estimated it to be down at 15,000 feet at this juncture, rough estimate. Suddenly, it blinked out visually. It disappeared from the GCI ground radar scope and its signal terminated. He put it into a climb back to 25,000, headed north, being low on fuel at this time, and suddenly it came back on the ECM monitor. GCI said it's 10 miles aft of you in tail position. He could not at this juncture see it because of the position of the blister on the B-47. The unknown source followed them up into Oklahoma and finally disappeared from GCI and from the monitor. Let's go. Now, to start, that took about 10 minutes to describe that single case. Just one UFO incident, but this involves, as you can see, six Air Force officers. It's a case from the Condon Report files. It is one in that category of unexplained cases, not explained cases in the Condon Report. There is some toying around with various ideas, but they don't even come near to fitting the phenomena, and it is conceded to be unexplained. And this I offer you as an example, just one example, of the puzzling phenomena that got through the filter of the Condon investigation without adequate explanation, and yet which are essentially ignored in Dr. Condon's final conclusion that there's nothing of further interest in the whole question and we should terminate further attention to the whole thing. Blue Book should be perhaps discontinued, and last week was. I say phenomena like that demand explanation. There are many, many more such instances. The next case that I take as an example is the Lakeney case that Dr. Hynek referred to very briefly, but which it takes me about six pages of very fine print to discuss at all adequately, because it's an extremely involved incident. It occurred in August of 1956 over eastern England in Suffolk. Lakenheath and Bentwaters are RAF stations. Incidentally, the reader of the Condon Report is not given dates or localities or witness names, and that makes it fairly difficult for some independent investigators to check it. But in this case, as in a number of others, I have secured the original Blue Book file reports. I still don't have the names because it is part of Blue Book policy to razor blade out names of all witnesses, and that complicates things a bit, but doesn't preclude recognition of when one has a significant incident. First of all, one again meets with a very deficient reporting in the Condon Report. Three quite puzzling radar incidents at Bentwaters GCA station on the east coast of England are not even mentioned in the Condon Report, but they constitute the beginning of this five-hour-long episode in which ground visual, airborne visual, ground radar, and airborne radar sightings of unidentified moving objects sources are involved. And the initial three sightings at Bentwaters on GCA radars involve very high-speed tracking, consistent tracking of echoes across the scope. The first one occurred at 9:30 in the evening. There are internally inconsistent speed estimates given. And this is very characteristic of Blue Book reports. It is excruciating to attempt scientific analysis of most of the Blue Book reports, because there was never any real follow-up. Instances were never clarified by anybody going back to the original witnesses. With rare exceptions, nobody went back to the original witnesses and got the most obvious shortcomings filled in. So one derives three different speeds for the first radar tracking plotting incident in this case, but they're all above 2,000 miles an hour. The most likely estimate of all three is the one that the radar operator gives in terms of the spacing of the blips, and that gave 12,000 miles per hour. Speeds range from 4, there are 4, 9, and 12,000 mile an hour estimates, all for this single sighting, all within the Blue Book report. None of them discussed further in the report, no other evidence of any further cross-check. But the point here is that on this MPN-11A GCA radar, the object moved from about 40 miles east to about 30 miles west of GCA, a track right across the radar, and that began this whole incident. Then there was a second high-speed sighting later on, but in between this, one of the tech sergeants at Bentwaters, these are American Air Force detachment personnel at an RAF station. The second of the three sightings involved 12 objects in rough array following three targets, I should say, in triangular formation. They moved across the scope from south to north in a 25-minute period at a speed that varied between 80 and 125 knots, quite unrelated to the wind speed, about a factor of four times greater than the wind speed, and about 90 degrees to the direction at the levels that were estimated, very much lower than the original speed, but corresponding to no known traffic. At the end of about 25 minutes, all 12 of the scattered targets merged into a single target, and then the target was motionless for 10 minutes on the scope. Then the single composite target, whose intensity was compared to that of a D-36, moved north a few more miles, stopped again for about 15 minutes, and then moved off scope. Again, here it would go from sort of hypersonic speeds, you might say, to very much subsonic speeds of targets that are not don't correspond to any known traffic. They merge, they remain motionless, and then move off the scope. This was followed by a third sighting at high speed from west to east again, up in the multi-thousand range. It was given as 2,000 to 4,000 miles an hour, moved entirely across the scope, unlike anything in the realm of anomalous propagation, not compatible at all with interference from another station, not comparable to electronic trouble, not moving along a radius or not stationary, but moving entirely across the scope. Well, a fourth sighting finally led to some action. None of this led to any major action. A fourth sighting at about 11 o'clock that night of another high-speed target west to east finally led to Bentwaters GCA alerting another American detachment at Lakenheath GCA. And it is only the subsequent parts of the report that are discussed in the Condon report, and very sketchily and in a very disturbing manner. All of the original teletype message from Lakenheath is reproduced verbatim in the Condon report with A, A1, A2, and so on, and only the answers, no questions. So the reader who is not already thoroughly familiar with the format of Air Force Regulation 200-2 is given the answers without the questions. And consequently, most people will have very little notion of what is really going on in this instant and how very puzzling it is. Shortly after the GCA unit at Lakenheath was alerted, the ground personnel saw an object coming in from the northeast. It stopped. This was a luminous object. All they saw was an intense light. Stopped and then moved eastbound. From that time on, both radar and visual observers were available. I should mention one other thing that occurred at Bentwaters on this last of the four Bentwaters sighting. There was a C-47 pilot at 4,000 feet over the field who saw, concurrent with the radar, saw a bright object move below his aircraft from west to east. Concurrently, a tower operator at GCA at Bentwaters saw a luminous object move over his altitude. He estimated a few thousand feet. These were concurrent with the radar observations, and this was the composite sighting at 2255 on August 13th of 56 that led to the alert of another station. They finally got that much action going, and I just mentioned that the Lakenheath personnel saw a luminous object come in, hover motionless, and then move off to the east. Then two radars, independent radars, different frequencies. One was an air route traffic control surveillance radar. The other was a GCA radar at Lakenheath. From this time on, are following all of the rest of the motion. It's very involved. I better not attempt to describe all of it. But let me just say that for quite some time, they tracked objects, sometimes one, sometimes several, which would move, hover motionless, then start out with, the report emphasizes with no apparent acceleration, just shift the speeds of the order of 600 to 800 miles an hour, move 10 to 20 miles, stop again, and this erratic start-stop, acceleration-deceleration motion was being tracked concurrently by two radars at Lakenheath and observed on the ground. Finally, they decided that an interceptor should be scrambled, and a Venom was scrambled from the Blue Book reports. One finds it was from Water Beach Aerodrome near Cambridge. The Venom was vectored into position on one of the targets being carried by GCA. He saw a luminous source and got a radar return as he moved in under the vector direction. And this again is significant. Here we have four channels, if you like, four known channels, two radars on the ground with different radar characteristics, an airborne radar in the Venom interceptor, and the pilot seeing a luminous object. The report is unclear whether there were also ground observers seeing this luminous source. But this kind of phenomenon, which does occur, I wish to emphasize, which you do find over and over again in the Wright-Patterson Blue Book files, is the sort of thing that makes me think we've got a scientific problem here. Suddenly, the Venom pilot reported that he lost the airborne radar return and the light had blinked out, somewhat reminiscent of the B-47 incident that had just occurred and reminiscent of other cases. He was then vectored to another one of the unknown targets they had been carried. He moved in. This time it didn't disappear from his scope, but a different thing happened. The very puzzling. Dr. Hynek alluded to it very briefly. The unknown target suddenly, and one of the supporting accounts emphasizes the swiftness of this maneuver, suddenly went from the pursued to the pursuer, went from ahead of the Venom to the tail position, and at that juncture the Venom interceptor pilot reported that he was unable to shake it, the 5 or 10 minutes of violent maneuvers, and the unknown target tracked on ground radar following this interceptor, the Venom, until the Venom ran out of fuel. They had to go back. The unknown target followed the Venom for some miles and then just stopped, motionless, and the Venom went on back to base. They got another Venom up in the air, but it never closed with the object. The radar reports continued until 03:30 in the morning. The account is not very detailed in the remaining part, but they finally lost all unknown targets at Lake Anith about 3.5 hours after they had been alerted. Okay, there is another single case, which has taken me another 10 minutes, I dare say, to discuss, and the point is that this is also left unexplained in the Conan report. Dr. Hynek quoted the remark about it, that perhaps this involved at least one genuine UFO, unquote. Point I make is that here is the kind of thing that has been occurring and has gone into Air Force files without adequate follow-up, without anything resembling any scientific clarification. Nobody at Air Force Cambridge asked to examine this, as far as one can tell from the files. There's a very brief discussion, very unsatisfactory discussion, about whether this could have been meteors. This, if you recognize the date, it is the date of the Perseids. But the count contains specific comments from the observers that they saw lots of shooting stars and that these targets were not in any way comparable to Perseids, and this is pretty obvious in the first instance. It is unexplained in the Air Force files. It is unexplained in the Conn report. I say it is a part of the phenomenon we're talking about here that demands scientific explanation, but has not got it. A third sighting, which I'll have to be very brief about, is an older one from that period of greatest report activity in UFOs, 1952. The Haneda Air Force Base radar visual case of August 5th of 52 is one of dozens of cases. I actually cited 110 cases when the Conan Project asked me for the kinds of cases that puzzled me. This was one that I suggested, one that the National Investigation Committee on Aerophenomena, NICAP, suggested, and they did examine it in the Conan report. And it is finally explained as diffraction from Capella and anomalous propagation. I say, look carefully, not at what is said in the Conan report, because it's about 5 paragraphs, but look at the Blue Book files. It's about 25 pages in the Blue Book case file, and you may join me in saying it is a very unusual case of diffraction and anomalous propagation. Ground observers at Haneda Air Force Base, which is near Tokyo, reported an intensely blue light. They alerted Shiroi GCI radar about 20 miles away. About 15 minutes later, another air base, American air unit, this is in the Korean period, Tachikawa, contacted Haneda and reported that they also were seeing a luminous target. Didn't say also, we said that this was an independent sighting. We asked Haneda if they saw anything. The lines of sight from Haneda and Tachikawa intersect over North Tokyo Bay, the area where, as I'll now point out, ground radar shortly began tracking an object and where airborne radar shortly found an object. Pressing it very strongly, let me turn next to the radar. Shiroi GCI, which is the nearest ground radar that could be brought into the picture, found stationary targets initially, and the ground observers reported primarily stationary objects in this period. They decided to scramble an F-94 from Johnson Air Force Base. The F-94B got in there. This is a F-94 with airborne radar, two pilot and radar men. Just before the F-94 got into position over North Tokyo Bay, the GCI was tracking a target in starboard orbit of about 3-mile radius. The case file shows the maps of the orbiting pattern. Starboard orbit, diameter about 8 miles, speeds varying from about 100 knots to about 300 knots, occasionally stopping. The target would stop, start again, vary its speed in starboard orbit. Second orbit around, they vectored the F-94, giving it position bearings on the unknown. It was vectored at 11 o'clock position, 6,000 yards, and it actually closed on the target at 10 degrees port and approximately 6 miles. Very close correspondence, so close that there is no question at all, and when you read the case file, that the F-94 was vectored onto the target that was being tracked in GCI. I mention this because the Conan report suggests that maybe there was never any correspondence between ground radar and with the airborne radar. Study of the case file rules this out, I think, incontrovertibly. The F-94 got radar return, but never got a lock on, never got it directly locked on. Almost as soon as the F-94 got it on its APG-33 airborne radar, the target accelerated to the northeast across the scope. It was a B scope on the radar, moved rapidly across scope. The F-94 went into a hard right turn and held radar return on this unknown for a minute and a half as it moved northeastward towards Shiroi, and both the F-94 and the target on Shiroi radar, until both moved into the ground clutter pattern. Evidently no MTI in use on this CPS-1 radar at Shiroi, until they moved into the ground clutter and were lost after 90 seconds. So here we have an old case that's been in the files for many years, was always regarded as unexplained in the Air Force files, but the Cunningham report explains this as anomalous propagation. Nothing in this radar history suggests anomalous propagation. A discrete target moving in starboard orbit at speeds of 150 to 300 miles an hour, a vectored airborne radar return on it, pilots following it, no visual sighting at any time from the ground radar or the F-94. But that part of it explained as anomalous propagation, and the visual sighting at Haneda is explained as diffraction of Capella. There are about six or eight independent errors of meteorological optics in the diffraction explanation. I discuss these in a lot of detail in my account, but I don't believe it's even worth taking time to spell them out, because I want to close with a brief comment about the last of the four illustrative sightings. It happens to be a case that Dr. Hynek just alluded to very briefly, but my discussion in the notes would take me much longer to cover. I emphasize the sighting at Kirtland Air Force Base, 1957, November 4th, 1957, some very different reasons. I had never heard of this case before the Cunningham report was published. I was very suspicious of the explanation, because the case occurred at night in rain, and the Cunningham explanation is that it's a light aircraft which lost its way and did a turn below an altitude of 300 feet, then climbed out and went off in the distance. Furthermore, the Cunningham report claims that it did this turn while hidden from sight behind some buildings. This occurred at Albuquerque Kirtland Air Force Base, and I thought it was very strange that CAA observers would be in a tower, and that there would be a block of airspace so large that any aircraft could do a 180-degree turn while hidden behind buildings, and that any pilot still living would do this at night in rain and then climb to 300 feet. So I began to check the case, and I eventually got in touch with both of these witnesses. The first thing that stunned me when I talked to Richard Kaser and Eugene Brink, both of whom are still with the now FAA, is that nobody in the Cunningham report and the Cunningham investigation ever interrogated either witness. Here is the kind of sighting where you have the sort of witnesses that you most want to get, trained observers under very favorable conditions. They were on duty in a CAA tower with binoculars looking at this thing, and the Cunningham group didn't even investigate them. That's true of a number of other Cunningham report cases, including some that are unexplained and some that are explained. Well, the Cunningham report goes along with the Air Force explanation that this was an aircraft that lost its way, but when I talked to the CAA observers, I learned that this luminous thing came down over the runway at runway 26 at Kirtland, then diagonal across the runways, leaving the safe runway area and moving across taxiways and over grass and everything else at about 10, 20 foot estimated altitude, until it hovered over a B-58 pad near the drumhead secure area in full view, and I emphasize this, of the tower observers. Both Brink and Kaser stressed that they got 7-power binoculars on this immediately. It was at a point about 3,000 feet from the tower with 7-power binoculars. This is 200 foot equivalent distance, and their description of it was, it was an egg-shaped object with a light on the bottom, completely unlike any aircraft that they had ever seen. Very emphatic about this. I got the Blue Book file report. It is equally clear on this point. The object hovered for a time of approximately a minute, then went eastward and climbed at a speed that both men emphasized to me and to the major from the Air Force Base who did the initial investigation, that it climbed at a rate that was unprecedented in their experience. In 1969, they said it was still, they'd never seen anything that compared with this. It disappeared into the overcast, was then tracked by the RAPCON radar, went south about 10 miles, hovered in tight orbit, and then came back and went into tail position behind a C-46 that was leaving Kirtland Air Force Base and disappeared from the scene. Well, that case, which I have just very briefly described, is considered explaining the Cunningham report. It is so considered without benefit of any contact with either of the two witnesses. The circumstances of the case are so utterly unlike anything described in the Cunningham evaluation that I cite this as an illustration of the very low level of argumentation that I would be able to cite many other examples of. In very brief summary, then, I say that we have a problem here that has been ignored. Science is in default for leading in this state for 20 years. Air Force Blue Book investigations and all of the consultant panels and groups they've brought to bear on it have not closed with the problem in an adequate way. The phenomena do defy ready explanation. The extraterrestrial hypothesis is the hypothesis, which I regard as least unlikely and perhaps most probable, obviously fraught with all kinds of immediate questions. But when you have looked, as I have, at hundreds of cases and interviewed, as I have, about 400 or 500 witnesses, you're stuck with a problem that fits no conventional terrestrial explanation, and this fascinating possibility that there might in fact be something roughly describable as extraterrestrial surveillance involved in the UFO problem is the possibility, the hypothesis, that I regard most probable. Thank you.